From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Frankie was a good girl, everybody knows. She paid $100 for our one suit of clothes. He's a man, and he done it wrong.
The American ballad is older than America itself. The music of every man and woman, sung by minstrels, farmers, fathers and mothers living along the back roads and broad plains of a vibrant and violent nation. The tradition harkens back centuries to medieval songs sung while dancing. It evolved to mean any narrative song, the freedom to tell a story free of any defined structure. Wide-ranging ballads blossomed in America. They became the medium through which Americans told each other about themselves and what stories they told of love and liberty, of death and murder, of sin and glory, darkness and redemption. Plain and powerful visions of America, all as true and tragic as the soil. Tonight on Point, the story of our nation through song, the American ballad.
Frankie shot old Albert, and she shot him 3 or 4 times. Says, throw back, I'd smoke him a gun, let me see his Albert dying. He's my man, and he done me wrong. And the judge walked down the stand, they walked outside the side. The judge says to Frankie, you're gonna be justified for killing a man, and he done you wrong.
And joining me now from San Francisco, California, is Greil Marcus. He is one of the nation's foremost music writers, author of many critically acclaimed books on American music, including Lipstick Traces, The Old Weird America, and Mystery Train. He and Grammy-nominated Princeton historian Sean Willance co-edited a new collection of essays titled The Rose and the Briar, Death, Love, and Liberty in the American Ballad. Welcome, Greil. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you.
Let me start with why this approach. This is wonderful music. Many of us grew up hearing it. Why the hookup of these great ballads and then a whole group of writers who essentially, you said, say what you want, write what you want, yes?
Well, we thought that the question of what the American ballad was, how it communicated, why it had lasted, what, if anything, made the American ballad different and special as opposed to the songs or the musics of other nations, other cultures, was a question that had not really been examined. In terms of getting to the actual heart of why so many of these songs have lasted, some of them for hundreds of years, and why modern ballads written today take their life, take their ambitions from the older songs, these questions hadn't been examined, and we thought maybe the most productive and unpredictable way to approach this would be to go to all different sorts of people who we admired, who we respected, and say, choose a ballad, whether it's old, whether it's new, and run with it. Take any approach you want, as long as you get to what made you choose this song in the first place, what attracted you to it. We approached Joyce Carol Oates. We approached the novelist Steve Erickson, the mystery writer Sharon McCrum, the poet Paul Muldoon, many critics and historians from James Miller to Dave Marsh, Ann Powers, Eric Weisbard, Wendy Lesser. And we also asked a number of musicians. This was not because we had any clear sense that these people were writers or even interested in writing, just that we could tell from their music, or maybe a stray liner note or two, that these people had unique sensibilities, that they would have a perspective both as thinkers and as musicians on ballads that we would never have.
And indeed they did.
They sure did.
I want to start with one song that is certainly a classic, and it's the one that you use for your title, and that's the song of Barbara Allen. Let's listen to some.
All in the merry month of May, when the green buds they were swelling, for the love of Barbary Ellen. He sent his servant to the town, to the place where she was dwelling. Saying, Master's sick and he sends for you. If your name be Barbary Ellen.
And Grill, this was recorded by Gene Ritchie in 1961. Why is this song so significant for you?
Well, this is a song that's probably the best loved and certainly one of the oldest ballads there is. It goes back at least 400 years, probably a good deal longer than that. And it migrated from England, from London, from the Scottish border to Appalachia. And there are counties in Virginia and in Kentucky where folklorists have collected over 100 different variants in a single county of this song. You know, it's a song that people learn in school. It's a song that just seems to have always been there. The great folklorist Harry Smith once used to play a party game, a parlor game, where after he'd had a bit to drink, he would say that he could guess what county in the United States, the entire country, a given person came from if that person would sing Barbara Allen. Hmm. And one of our contributors to this book, Luke Sant, actually saw him do it with Luke's own girlfriend. So he was absolutely astonished.
And what is it about this one that it is such a haunting song? I think you can only hear it once, and it just stays with you.
It's a song about a boy who has been rejected by the girl he loves, who he has previously insulted, although he didn't quite realize it. So he turns his face to the wall and determines to die. But she is sent for, and he says, if you'll just favor me with a smile, then I'll have a reason to go on living. But she's been insulted, she's been scorned, and so she refuses to give him that smile, and he wills himself to die. And then suddenly overcome with grief and guilt, she does the same. As sweet William died for me today, I will die for him tomorrow. And she dies. Now, the funny thing is that you can hear this song over and over and over again. It can just sound like a curio to you, or it can stab you right in the heart. You can live your entire life without being actually caught by it, the way that Dave Marsh, who writes about this song in our book, seems to have been caught by it over and over again. And that's one of the real gifts, one of the true dramas that great ballads hold within them. You can feel as if it can be true that you've heard these songs all your life, and then suddenly it's like you've never heard it before. Suddenly it comes to full life. And that can be true with Frankie and Albert, with The Water is Wide, with a modern ballad like Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. These songs, which carry stories within them, sometimes wait. They bide their time until you're ready to fall into their trap.
Oh, she was buried 'neath the old church tower, and he was buried anigh her, and out of his bosom grew a red, red rose. Out of Barbary's grew a green briar. They grew and they grew up the old church tower until they could grow no higher. They locked and tied in a true lover's knot, red rose wrapped around the green briar.
And speaking of falling into traps, so many of these ballads contain warnings, and especially for girls. You know, this was pre-sex education class time. A song like Pretty Polly, for example, tells a little bit about the consequences of what may have been careless love. We're not sure. And Greil, tell us a little bit about why so many of these songs are about death and murder and the consequences of actions that you may later regret. This is a psychotic slaying in this song.
It's absolutely psychotic. It's one of the most fearsome ballads there is, and it gets to how the transformation of an old English song into an American song deepens its power. In the original British version of this song, the girl is pregnant, and her lover determines to kill her because he doesn't want the responsibility, he doesn't want the obligations. And so everything is quite clear. But in the American version, either because of prudery or because of a bet on mystery, the motive is removed. We don't know anything about Pretty Polly except that she's willing to go with Willie into the forest. She doesn't really seem to know why, whether there's a sexual attraction, whether he's promised that they're going to get married, that he's going to give her fine things. But if so, why go into the woods? But she goes with him, and he kills her. He cuts her. He stabs her in the breast. Her blood flows all over the forest floor. And when he takes her into the forest, he takes her to the grave that's already been dug. There's no motive.
How chilling is that? Here's the grave I've been digging all night.
That's what makes the song so scary. Yes, I dug on your grave the best part of last night. Mm. There are a lot of ways to look at why so many ballads are full of death, are pointing toward death, that death is their goal. One could be that, as you said earlier, this is and always has been a tremendously violent country. And one of the reasons it's so violent is the theme of liberty that runs through our national identity, which at its basest level means I can do whatever I want, nobody can stop me. That's true liberty. There's another way of looking at it too, though. I think one of the reasons why in our hidden art we are so obsessed with death is that the country itself is fragile. It's a construct. I think we have always feared that the country itself might cease to exist, might simply vanish, that maybe all it really is that piece of paper we call the Constitution, that they're, in fact, that it's entirely a fiction, as much of a fiction as a ballad, and that the nation itself could die. And thus we tell ourselves stories that focus on death as a way of somehow getting to that without actually addressing the true fear, the true terror. Another way of looking at it is that people love to hear stories about death. They love to hear stories about violence. It's exciting. It's chilling. It's like watching a movie and covering your eyes and peeking through your fingers. We like that.
We're going to continue on that theme with the 1938 recording of Pretty Polly by the Coon Creek Girls. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Pretty Polly, you're getting a bad ride. Oh, Polly, Pretty Polly, you're getting a bad ride. I dug on your grave the biggest part of last night. Oh, Willie, please spare me my life. Oh, Willie, Willie, please spare me my life. So deep into her bosom, he flung that fatal knife. Oh, she fell to the ground, and the blood is it flow. She fell to the ground, and the blood it did flow. And then to her grave, Pretty Polly did go. Oh, I threw the dirt around her and turned to go home. Oh, I threw the dirt around her and turned to go home and left Pretty Polly with a bird to weep and moan.
I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're continuing to talk this hour about The Rose and the Briar, Death, Love, and Liberty in the American Ballad, with Greil Marcus, who is the co-editor, along with Sean Willens, of this new book. We're going to listen right now to one called Come Sunday, and it's Mahalia Jackson and Duke Ellington, recorded in 1958.
Lord, dear Lord of love, God Almighty, God above, please look down and see my people through. Lord, dear Lord of love, God Almighty, God above, please look down and see my people through. Often we feel weary, but He knows our every care. Go to Him and see.
Girl, you've written that this version is one of the great milestones of modern American music. How so?
Well, in fact, the essay in The Rose and the Briar on Come Sunday is by the New York critic Stanley Crouch. And he chose this, as some of our other contributors did, partly to get at the question of what a ballad is sideways. There's no way in the world that anyone would listen to Come Sunday about the importance of Sunday as a day not only of respite, but a day of praising God and a day of affirming one's identity within the African-American community as a ballad. It doesn't tell a story. It doesn't say so-and-so woke up, he walked down the street, he committed this act, and then such consequences followed. It's not that kind of storytelling song. But to Stanley, it is a ballad. It is perhaps the American ballad because it pulls into itself the entire story, the odyssey of Black America over hundreds of years. And so his essay is a retelling of the story that the ballad does not tell literally. It joins the ballad. And, you know, I have to admit, this was not music I knew, and that was true with many of the contributions in the book. And I felt ashamed of my own ignorance, but also thrilled that this great treasure was there to be discovered for the first time, as I'm sure for some readers of our book, it will be discovered for the first time.
Well, and you certainly discovered, along with Sean, some great approaches by some of these writers. There's one that's just a terrific treatment of Ami Wise, which is a ballad based on an 1807 murder in North Carolina, and it's framed as a letter to an aunt. Let's listen to a little bit of it, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll tell you all a story about Ami Wise, how she was deluded by John Lewis's lies. He told her to meet him at Adams this spring. He'd bring her some money and some other fine things. He brought her no money nor no other fine things. But get up behind me, Ami, to Squire Ellis we'll go. She got up behind him, so carefully we'll go. They rode till they came where deep waters did flow. John Lewis, he concluded to tell her his mind. John Lewis, he concluded to leave her behind.
And that recording of Ami Wise was done by G.B. Grayson in 1927. And Greil Marcus, interesting way to think about this story as told in the first person.
Ami Wise was murdered by John Lewis in North Carolina in 1807. This recording was made in the 1920s, but it's in the style that would have been current in 1807. And the ballad itself emerged almost immediately after the crime. So we were listening right there to one of the most archaic performances ever recorded of American music. Now, Anna Domino is a singer and a musician. She and her partner, Michelle DeLore, working under the name of Snake Farm, put out a remarkable album in 1999 called Songs from My Funeral. It was a collection of the oldest American ballads, Frankie and Johnny, John Henry, all done in a kind of techno style. And I invited her to contribute to this book without knowing anything about her except the way she sang on that album. I thought, this person has an interesting sensibility. I wonder what she would come up with. It never occurred to me that she was in her soul a writer. And Sean Wilentz said when we received her piece, Ami Wise writing to her aunt the night that she's going out to meet John Lewis, who's going to take her away to marry her, she believes, but in fact is going to kill her. She writes to her aunt describing all the disasters and setbacks and suffering of her life over the past few years, but now everything's going to change. Everything's going to be okay. She finishes the letter, and she goes off to meet John Lewis. And when Sean Wilentz read this, he said, I know how people wrote in 1807. I know how a literate person, but who is nevertheless uneducated, someone who is striving for a higher tone than she really knows how to reach. I know how the subtleties of this kind of prose read in 1807. But how did Anna Domino know? Because he said she had perfect pitch. So this was one of the great shocks for us as editors and as readers.
One of the other great things that comes across is how these ballads really connect us to our past.
Well, there is a sense in the ballad that it's telling a story that happened once and yet deserves to be retold for all time. There is a feeling within any great ballad that it's permanent, that there's nothing transitory about it, that its story is of an appeal that isn't local, that isn't temporal, that hundreds of years from now people will be just as interested in it as the ballad maker is when he or she came up with it. And the great modern ballads, like Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska, Jan and Dean's Dead Man's Curve, seem to have that same kind of confidence. Maybe Marty Robbins' El Paso from 1959 is the best example of that.
Yes, doesn't that sound as if it's been around for at least 100 years?
Exactly. It sounds as if it's always been present. And Marty Robbins, who wrote the song, said as much. He said, "I wrote this song, but this is what you would have heard in the 1880s in Texas."
Sorry to jump in on you, but let's listen to a little bit of that.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl. Blacker than night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was deep for this Mexican maiden. I was in love, but in vain I could tell. One night a wild young cowboy came in, wild as the West Texas wind. Dancing and daring, a drink he was sharing with wicked Felina, the girl that I love. So in anger I challenged his right for the love of this maiden. Down went his hand for the gun that he wore. My challenge was answered in less than a heartbeat. A handsome young stranger lay dead on the floor.
And Greil Marcus, that was recorded by Marty Robbins in when? 1959, I think?
Right. God, isn't that great?
It's
amazing.
You can
just see it all happening as you listen.
You feel as if you've pulled up a chair at a nearby table, you know, and watched all this unfold, don't you?
Yeah, and you know, this song is really unique. It has something that I don't think any other American ballad has. Most American ballads that involve confrontation, a shooting, a killing, is closer to that Johnny Cash song, Folsom Prison Blues, where he says, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die." There's that sadism in it. Where here, the hero of the song, the narrator of the song, shoots the handsome young cowboy coming into Rose's Cantina because he's the rival for the affections of Felina. He pulls his gun, he shoots the handsome young cowboy, and then he says, "I was shocked by the foul, evil deed I had done." It's just unheard of in the American ballad for there to be any expression of remorse,
exactly,
of doubt. And here, suddenly, we don't know where we are. Oh, my God. He said he did the wrong thing. Now what does he do? This isn't what the ballad hero does. And so we're really in a new story here.
As you and Sean were working on this book and on this concept, was there any question about doing a CD? Because as you read it, as wonderful as these stories are and as evocative as they are, you do find yourself reading the words and thinking, oh, what does that sound like?
We decided early on that it would be a wonderful thing if we could have an album that would accompany the book. And we went to Sony Legacy, and we approached them, and they agreed to put out an album with the same title, the same cover, but it would include the versions of the songs that the people were writing about, almost every one of them, as many as we could fit onto a single disc. One of the great boons of this was not just to have this music together and to see how it would work together, whether it's Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan, the songs that we've heard, Marty Robbins, Clarence Ashley, but we wanted the musicians who wrote for the book to be on the CD as much as possible, and they wanted something completely new on the CD. So they asked John Mellencamp to record Wreck of the Old 97, the train wreck song from the early part of the 20th century. He went into the studio on his own with his band, cut a version of this train wreck song. Is completely different from any version I've ever heard. It's normally a kind of rollicking, good-timey sing-along, God knows why, since it's about this horrible disaster. And from the very first note of John Mellencamp's version, you know that it's about death. So we were able to play around with this and both bring music that people might want to hear together and play with the whole idea of what the ballad is at the same time.
Let's go to The Cuckoo Bird now. This is one that was recorded by Clarence Ashley in 1929, another story of love, including estrangement and some mysticism. And what's the story behind the story there, Greil?
This is The Cuckoo Bird. The cuckoo is somebody throwing bright, shiny baubles at you, purple, green, blue, red, and your eye is caught by one after the other, and you can't focus on any one of these jewels as they fly into the air, and so they ultimately all escape you. That's how the cuckoo bird works. Each verse is about something completely different. They don't seem to relate at all. The singer is building a log cabin so he can see Willie walk by. Why in the world would he be doing that? Huh. He's playing cards all over the world and challenging a rival to one more game. He's talking about the cuckoo and how she never hollers cuckoo till the fourth day of July. And there are many, many other verses that could be thrown in. And what the song ultimately is about is the way things don't fit together, the way the telling a narrative story where one thing leads to another is an ultimate falsification of what life is all about. The cuckoo is like Shakespeare. Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. It is, in its way, the ultimate anti-ballad. It says there is no such thing as a story. There's no beginning. There's no end. And that's the attraction of it. It is a great vortex. It is a black hole in the American ballad. And all the nice stories with their comforting conclusions are sucked into that and destroyed.
We are continuing our exploration of the American ballad in just a moment with Greil Marcus. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I play cards in England. I play cards in Spain. I'll bet you $10 I beat you this game. Oh, the cuckoo is a pretty bird. She wobbles as she flies. She never hollers cuckoo till the fourth day, July.
I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're continuing this hour to explore death, love, and liberty in the American ballad. The book is The Rose and the Briar by Greil Marcus and Sean Willens, co-editors. And here's a bit of Dolly Parton and a song called Down from Dover.
I know this dress I'm wearing doesn't hide the secret I have tried concealing. When he left, he promised me that he'd be back by the time it was revealing. The sun behind a cloud just cast a crawling shadow o'er the fields of clover. And time is running out for me. I wish that he would hurry down from Dover. He's been gone so long. When he left, the snow was deep up on the ground. And I have seen a spring and summer pass, and now the leaves are turning brown. At any time, a tiny face will show itself, 'cause waiting's almost over. But I won't have a name to give it if he doesn't hurry down from Dover.
Oh, and Greil Marcus, another one of those that leaves you with some chills, you know, another woman done wrong.
Well, at least in this case, she isn't murdered by the guy who got her pregnant.
Good point. She is still alive.
She gets to sing her song, and not from beyond the grave. But, you know, this is a Dolly Parton song that she wrote probably in the earlier mid-60s, didn't record until 1970, and has disappeared from Dolly Parton albums. The only place you can hear this recording, right now anyway, is on the Rose and the Briar collection, which is really ridiculous. This is one of her greatest performances, and it's so delicate. It's so measured. From verse to verse, you can feel that she still believes this man is going to come down from Dover, Tennessee, and rescue her. She's been kicked out by her family. She's been scorned by everyone. The baby is getting closer and closer, and she's more and more terrified. And it isn't until the very end that she realizes that this guy is never coming back. And yet, when you think about it in terms of Pretty Polly, when you think about it in terms of so many other ballads where either explicitly or implicitly Scott Peterson rides on his black steed. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what we're hearing. We are hearing the Scott Peterson, Lacey Peterson story told again and again and again, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. You see how the oldest stories are being reenacted in our own time. In this case, Dolly Parton is no victim. Dolly Parton is never going to write a murder ballad in which she gets killed. She will always get the last word.
But a cautionary tale nonetheless. Greil, we were listening a few moments ago to Marty Robbins' new song. The Dolly Parton song is new as well. One of my personal favorites has always been Randy Newman's piece on Sail Away. Tell me a little bit about that song.
The essay in The Rose and the Briar on Sail Away and Randy Newman's Louisiana 1927 is by the novelist Steve Erickson, and it's one of the most frightening pieces in the book. This is a piece where Sail Away, where a recruiter for the slave trade goes to Africa and is telling all the Africans how great America is and how they're going to get to come to America and realize all their dreams. And it's the land of milk and honey. It's just an absolutely insane, ludicrous, mad, sadistic conception, let alone performance, all done with the loveliest movie music, with just this sense of evoking grand vistas and purple mountains, majesty and
enticement. You don't have to run through the jungle and scuff up your feet.
Oh, it's just going to be so great. You're all going to be an American. And this is all about slavery. This is all about death, destruction, destruction of families, humiliation, degradation, torture, mutilation, everything abominable, imaginable. And it's all... It's far beyond sugar-coated. It's wrapped in gold and silver. On the other side is Louisiana 1927, long after slavery has ended and the South nevertheless still absolutely consumed with guilt, with a sense that what seem like natural disasters are actually God's punishment for the sin that still stains the land. And Steve Erickson brings these two songs together by focusing on Lincoln's second inaugural in 1865 and says there were three Americas. There was the America of slavery, there was the America after slavery, and there was an America that maybe only existed for as long as it took Lincoln to deliver that second inaugural address, where he saw through what it would take for America to live up to its own crimes, to acknowledge its own crimes. It's utterly frightening. And right in the middle of that is Randy Newman's Con Man, the smoothest operator of all time, saying, come on, little wog, get on the boat, you're going to love it. And that's the most frightening of all.
Greil Marcus, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It was great. It's wonderful to have a chance to talk about this.
Greil Marcus is co-editor, along with Sean Willens, of the new book, The Rose and the Briar, Death, Love, and Liberty in the American Ballad. Hear now more of Randy Newman and Sail Away. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Ain't no lion or tiger, ain't no mama snake. Just a sweet watermelon in the buckwheat cake. Everybody is as happy as a man can be. Climb aboard, little wog, sail away with me. Sail away. Sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away. Sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
Now is the time to confront Social Security. And so I'm looking forward to working with members of both chambers and both parties to confront this issue today before it becomes more acute.
No confidence. But that does not mean I call for his resignation, because the President of the United States, by virtue of his election, should have the team that he wants around him.
The Interceptor never even got off the ground. The target missile, carrying the mock warhead it was to hit, was successfully launched from Alaska, but officials say the Interceptor missile had some sort of anomaly and shut itself down.
Mr. Chairman, we have determined there have been 20 votes cast for President George W. Bush, and 20 votes cast for Vice President Dick Cheney.
Our intelligence community is analyzing it to see whether it actually is bin Laden. It appears to be.
Upon learning of the potential lethal side effect of the Navarapaz, President Bush and his administration did nothing to stop the shipment and usage of the drug in Africa. They must be held accountable for their inaction.
People of the State of California versus Scott Peterson, we the jury in the above entitled cause fix the penalty at death.
President Bush calls for changes to Social Security during his economic summit. Senator John McCain and several other prominent Republicans say they have no confidence in Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. In another blow for Rumsfeld, the first test of the new missile defense system in 2 years fails miserably. President Bush's victory is confirmed as the Electoral College casts its ballots, but legal challenges to Ohio's results continue. Osama bin Laden returns on an audio tape, cheering on the Iraqi insurgency and calling for a nonviolent overthrow of the Saudi royal family. A new report says the U.S. government withheld information about the safety and efficacy of the AIDS drug nevirapine, which the U.S. distributes in Africa. And a California jury sentences Scott Peterson to death. Jack Beatty, what strikes you most about this week?
Well, I came across two stories that threw light on the hidden casualties of the war. One, an outstanding piece in the Scripps Howard News Service about the children left behind. Because so many people in the military today are married, so many of the dead are leaving a disproportionate number of children as compared to other wars behind. 900 children have been left without a parent, including among the dead, 6 women who left among them 10 children. Mm. And their suffering is something we just don't think about, I guess, when we see those casualty figures. But that's a big part of it, and that goes on for all their lives. And then the second study was on the front page of the New York Times, and this was on the psychiatric casualties of the war. estimates of 100,000 soldiers needing some kind of psychiatric intervention. And quoted one person as saying, we'll be seeing these people over the next 35 years.
No surprise, then, that the recruiting numbers are down.
Gosh, no. I mean, we were talking about this last week. Who would want to join this? And then I really think Mr. Rumsfeld himself must be a discouragement to recruitment. And I suspect he may finally be on the way out. When you have not just conservative senators, but conservative publicists like William Kristol calling for his resignation, I think maybe a threshold has been crossed.
And what about President Bush and Social Security changes? Is this the same tune, second verse?
Well, you know, I'm very glad you said changes. We had a caller earlier this week from North Carolina who reminded us, we don't know whether this is a reform, Social Security reform. We know it's a change. And we shouldn't say reform until it is proven to be a good idea. And that is so right. And those of us in journalism, I salute you for saying change. It's very important because we don't know whether it's a reform. And there are some echoes here of the lead into Iraq. We have the president saying now, as he did then, the dangers of inaction are worse than the dangers of action, that we have this, it looks like a distant crisis, but really it's an imminent crisis. It's practically around the corner. Worst case scenarios then, worst case scenarios now. He succeeded then, and the question is whether he will succeed now. I mean, he's going to have against him his record on credibility. He's going to have against him the clear evidence, even in the actuarial tables, that this is not as grave a crisis as he makes out. But he's going to have for him the fact that there'll be powerful lobbies for this. 14% of this will go, of your Social Security contributions would go to Wall Street to manage these funds. That's trillions of dollars over decades. Those folks are going to take out a lot of ads.
And also a big milestone for Bill Moyers.
Well, you know, there really is. He was a pretty bare-knuckle guy when I first found out about him when he worked for Lyndon Johnson, and he was known as for example, he was the guy that okayed or had a lot to do with the famous Daisy commercial of 1964 that made it sound like Barry Goldwater wanted to blow up the world, although maybe Barry sometimes gave that impression. But boy, has he repented over the years, and it is tonight's his last broadcast. And in a quick comment to the New York Times, he said something I think that's so necessary to our profession. He said, I learned the hard way, an old lesson, that the greatest moments in the history of the press came not when journalists made common cause with the state, but when they stood fearlessly independent of it. He added, now we have those mega media companies that won't speak truth to power and an ideological media that willingly lies for power. Scary, he said.
Well, Jack Beatty, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Rachel Dornhelm, Lauren Madelon, and Matt Odette. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.